Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1319, we feature three stories by two new Life Rattle writers, Phyllis Mack and Jason Swetnam. All three stories on tonight's program start off from a workplace setting, yet each writer expands on the work theme and takes their stories into totally different realms. Our first reader, Phyllis Mack, was born in the spring of 1995 in Mississauga, the older sister of a smart younger brother, the daughter of an imaginative mum and a hard-working dad. Both of her parents emigrated from Hong Kong 21 years ago. Phyllis spent the majority of her childhood painting incredibly bad pictures, she says, and writing curious little stories, until she got busted tricking a teacher into thinking that she had nine siblings. Presently, Phyllis attends university, where she enjoys studying English and professional writing. In her free time, she either hops over to the archery range with her family to shoot a few ends, or attempts to wake up before noon. Phyllis Mack writes with a restraint that grants readers the latitude to absorb the atmosphere of her setting. The psychic space she creates allows the subtlety of her words to penetrate slowly. We are not told how to feel about a given situation. She brings us there and lets our awareness develop at its own pace. Our first story tonight takes place in a distant corner of a hockey arena concourse, where our narrator, a young woman, stands post at an isolated exit used by those who leave the arena to smoke and then return. She works alone. Let's listen now as Phyllis Mack reads her story, Working at the Smoker's Pit, tonight on Life Rattle.
Working at the Smoker's Pit by Phyllis Mack. The stale smell of cigarette smoke assaults my nose as I let the last smoker back into the concourse. His face is shiny and red from the cold night air. The man smiles at me, and I smile back, even though it's hard to breathe past the heavy stench that seeps from his coat. The door closes with a loud clank, and the fumes are, thankfully, blocked out once again. It's hockey night, and the team from Barrie is playing against our mediocre Mississauga team. From where I stand, I see families, teenagers, and devout fans flood into the rink. Their arms are piled with popcorn bags, soft drinks, and small flags with images of the team mascots emblazoned on the cheap polyester material. My post is the Smoker's Pit, by Door 9. It's my job to stamp the guests' hands when they exit the building to smoke, and to let them back in once they've inhaled their nicotine. Hours pass, and my feet hurt, and my shoulders begin to ache. Only the occasional guest has wandered by, looking for a bathroom or a concession stand. It's been quiet for so long that when somebody finally approaches me, I jump in surprise. Help! A tall, older man, wearing a white polo shirt under his dark windbreaker, hurries up to me. His eyes are open wide, and his face is slightly flushed. He sounds extremely panicked. Is there something wrong, sir? I ask, trying to keep calm. Yes, the man says, waving his hands in a dramatic manner. I can't breathe. I stammer. Would you like me to find the paramedic on site? Do you need to sit down? Are you on any medication? No. The man disregards my words. I think I need CPR. From you. I stare at him for a moment, nonplussed, until I finally realize, from the growing grin on his face, that he is joking. My eye twitches a little in annoyance, but for the sake of customer service, I smile back and say, "That's very funny, sir." He throws his head back and lets out a hearty laugh. I can see hints of white in the hair at his temple. "I'm just messing with you," he says brightly, and takes a step closer. I can smell beer on him. I take a minuscule step back. "What's your name?" he asks. And for a second, I can't reply. I don't want to give him my name. "Ah, it's Phyllis," it says right there. He points at the name tag pinned to my shirt. His eyes linger on my chest. I take a bigger step back. "Yes, that's my name," I reply, clasping my hands in front of me. "So, there's no problem at tonight's game, sir? Are you sure you don't need a paramedic?" "Nah." The man gives an exaggerated shrug. "I'm just playing with ya. My name's Mike, by the way." He extends his hand for a handshake, invading the tiny bit of distance I've managed to put between us. I hesitate for a second before accepting his hand, a little slimy from sweat. He grins. I smile back, strained. I realize how silent the area near the smoker's pit is, and how empty the concourse is while the puck is in play. I swallow nervously and let go of his hand. "Nice to meet you, Mike." My words are slightly high-pitched. "You work here often?" Mike asks. "I work when I'm assigned a shift," I say evasively, wondering if I'm being impolite. I shift nervously. I see, Mike says, thoughtfully. I nod my head. The silence continues until he claps his hands together and says, "Well, I better get back to my seat. Maybe I'll run into you again later, Phyllis. Nice to meet ya." "No, not really," I think as I automatically reply. "Enjoy the game, sir." He walks away. The muscles in my jaw relax. I didn't realize I had been clenching it shut this whole time. Another hour passes before the game finishes, and the guests begin to file out of the doors. By the time two of my co-workers, Anna and Pauline, come around to distribute garbage bags and gloves for the usual post-game cleanup, the tension in my shoulders is almost gone. Pauline asks, "Did some guy come up and talk to you earlier?" Yeah. Some guy did try to make conversation with me." Anna and Pauline exchange looks. "A man came up to us asking about you when we started handing garbage bags out," Anna says. My eye twitches. "He asked about me." "Yeah, like where you worked, if you're usually by the smoker's pit, or something like that," Pauline replies. "It was creepy." "No kidding," I mutter, twisting the bag in my hand. "He didn't try anything funny, did he?" "No," I sigh. "Nothing. It was just a really awful conversation." Pauline nods knowingly. "I know exactly what you mean," she says, and Anna hums in agreement. "It's so damned stupid. Annoying as hell." I laugh. Anna hands me a pair of blue plastic gloves, and they depart. Their footsteps echo as they walk along the concrete floors, leaving me alone, once more, in the quiet, smoke-scented corner of the hockey stadium.
That was Working at the Smoker's Pit, written and read by Phyllis Mack. Along with one story from every writer featured in this year's radio programming, Working at the Smoker's Pit will be published in this year's Totally Unknown Writers Festival anthology. Tonight's second reader, Jason Swetnam, was born in Spring Hill, Nova Scotia in 1972. He grew up in Amherst on the wrong side of the tracks, but crossed to the other side in time for high school, where he learned the habitude of the right side of town. Since then, Jason has tried to find his own place in the world. He's looked for it on a boat in the Pacific, a camel in the Sahara, a bicycle in California, and at various universities, in Halifax, then England, and now again in Toronto. He used to hitchhike everywhere, then he started riding his bike everywhere. Now, Jason subsists on those memories, while he waits for his kids to get old enough to talk them into going on adventures with him. Jason Swetnam lives with his partner and kids in a house in Toronto, where he teaches high school English and philosophy, and feels guilty for not writing as much as he wants to. The prose of Jason Swetnam will stay with you for a while. His fully realized characters have such complexity that days from now you will still ponder their motivations. Again, as in Phyllis Mack's Working in the Smoker's Pit, Jason Swetnam's featured stories begin with a work theme, but by the time we come to the end, the idea of work is a distant memory. In Jason's first story tonight, the workplace environment of a group home fades quickly in comparison to a particularly chilling resident whose behavior has haunted me since I first read this story over a year ago. Let's listen now as Jason Swetnam reads his story, Ron's Smile.
Ron's Smile. Ron, what are you doing in there? Leave me alone. Ron, what are you doing? Leave me alone. I'm putting my smile on. I see Ron's rounded back through the open bathroom door. He hunches over the sink and does something in front of the mirror with his hands. 10 minutes later, Ron emerges from the bathroom with a massive smile on his face. He looks at me and says, "I happy now." I shiver inside but say, "That's great, Ron." I notice that his pajamas, like a little boy's except adult size, are soaked. I know what with, but I wait for him to tell me. Our morning routine has rules, and I always feel like Ron just waits for me to mess it up. I've worked for the Regional Residential Services Society's Clayton Park Group Home since my first year at Dalhousie University, usually the night shift. I arrive at 11 and stay awake all night to make sure no incidents happen with the residents. The house is usually quiet. Screams can sometimes be heard, mostly from Rick, who has night terrors. I want to know what he screams about. I'd like to be able to help him more than I do. 7 people live in the group home, all former patients of the Nova Scotia Hospital, a psychiatric facility in Dartmouth. They live at Clayton Park with the goal of integrating back into society. In the mornings, I wake them up and get them ready for work. I feed them breakfast and help them dress. I help a couple of them wipe their bums. I give them their morning meds. Most of them take haloperidol, an antipsychotic medication. 6 of them go to work in the same van. They make buttons and stuff envelopes in a workshop. It seems to make them happy. That leaves me and Ron. I don't feel 100% on my game this morning because this is my last shift of ever doing this. In an hour, I'm done. I've finished university. I'm leaving Halifax. My van, packed and ready, waits for me in the driveway. Ron, I have your bath running in the back bathroom. When you are ready, you should go down there and remove your pajamas and get in. I will have your cereal waiting for you in the kitchen. I had a good dream last night. Oh yeah? It was about Perry. Ron has a good day if he dreams about Perry, who lives down the hall. Ron tapes his drawings of Perry all over his wall. In most of the drawings, Perry dresses like a pilgrim in a black and white shirt and large-brimmed pilgrim's hat. In these pictures, Perry, always pantless, has a gigantic penis that hangs down to the floor. Ron also has a good day if he wets the bed. The wetter the bed, the better his day, usually. But this morning, he had to put a smile on. I hear Ron in the back bathroom making exaggerated bathing noises. Until now, I had never heard a bath sound angry. Something has fouled his mood. I think of the time, a couple of years ago, when Ron came home in such a bad mood he locked himself in his room and shaved for 2 hours straight with his electric razor. When he came out, his face raw, he said, "I happy now." It's almost 9 a.m. Bill, one of the full-time counselors, should come through the front door any minute to relieve me. I hear wet feet on the tile floor. I turn around. Ron's fist shocks my jaw and shakes my brain. Ron, naked and wet, digs his long fingernails into my cheek. I manage to get Ron into a headlock and escort him to the timeout room, as we are taught to say. A few minutes later, I hear Bill put his backpack down on the chair beside the kitchen door. I tell him what happened. I write up my final report on my final shift. I look through the peephole of the timeout room door. Ron stands against the far wall, hands folded at his crotch, looking down. His hair hangs over his eyes. He doesn't smile.
That was Ron's Smile, written and read by Jason Swetnam. In Jason's second story, teaching English as a second language in South Korea is the launching board for a delicate affair between instructor and adult student. Let's listen now as Jason Swetnam reads his story, Mikyung.
Mikyung. I work long days teaching a range of subjects at the Naeja English Academy in Chuncheon, South Korea. Vocabulary for kids with dried squid breath, conversation for earnest businessmen in three-piece suits, grammar for undergrads with stuffed animals dangling from their backpacks, and literature for Korean housewives. On my first day, when I saw housewives on the timetable, I expected Ajumas wearing nylon windbreakers and tight perms with thermoses of tea and tin lunchboxes of kimchi and rice. What I found were beautiful, educated, neglected women with time on their hands. 2 weeks into the class, a new housewife shows up. She comes in late, and we all stop talking. She introduces herself. Her name is Mikyung. She does not have nor want an English name. She's 40, married to a French professor, has a 16-year-old daughter, holds an English literature degree, and wears tumbled stone necklaces that dip into the wells of her collarbones. With an hour of class remaining, we all try to get resettled. But I notice that I find myself often talking only to Mikyung. The other housewives shift in their seats. Some cough, and some raise their hands. They ask about Heathcliff or Mr. Rochester. But Mikyung and I keep talking about Hemingway. I love how there's no cause and effect with Hemingway. It's all and, she says. Me too. I love that too. Bullfights and wars and well-lit rooms. You've summed Hemingway up. The class ends. The housewives go home. I order kalguksu. The restaurant driver delivers the food to my school on a moped. When I finish eating, I leave the ceramic bowl and metal chopsticks outside the door to be picked up later. I have time to kill before my next class on CNN News. Students watch the previous night's newscast in English and copy it down, word for word. I have a foot pedal that rewinds the show. I preview the news for tonight's class. When it's done, my foot hits the pedal to rewind it, and I think about Mikyung. My foot hits the pedal again, and I think about Mikyung. 4 weeks into the class, after the housewives have left and we are alone, Mikyung tells me that she thinks about me. A crate of apple pears arrives at my apartment on a Saturday morning with no note, but I know it's from Mikyung. She calls me on the phone, and we meet in the evening, and she drives me around Chuncheon. This becomes a routine, and each time, the drives get longer and farther from town. One night, we find ourselves in a hotel bar off the highway between Chuncheon and Seoul, drinking and watching the lights on the river. We look at each other. Do you want to get a room? I say. Yes, she says. 6 months into the class, this extracurricular activity becomes unfun. Her kisses need too much of me. I ask too many questions about her husband. She gets careless with her excuses to him. Mikyung figures it out that I am no longer into the relationship. She doesn't show up to class. The third time this happens, with 10 minutes left, my boss, Mr. Cho, leans through the doorframe with a concerned look. "There's a phone call for you," he says. I walk out of the room, make my way to the main office, and pick up the phone. "I need to see you. This isn't a good time. I need to see you. Okay, tonight." Mi-kyung's car waits outside my building. The exhaust fumes rise and mix with the red taillights and rain, and it looks like a movie set for a cliched story about a breakup. The headlights of the car shine down on the ground. I get in, but we don't go anywhere. We sit and wait for the other to speak. "What are you thinking about?" she asks. "What are you thinking about?" "I asked you first." "Nothing. You?" "I don't know. Think about me." "I can't." "Why?" "I don't know." "Speak." "I can't." "Why?" "I'm not a dog. Be more specific." "Woof." "Is that funny?" "Woof." "Why are you so quiet?" "Why are you?" "We're both quiet." "Why?" "Many reasons." "Like what?" "I don't know." "Will you remember me?" "Yes." "Yes?" "Yes, I will, of course. What do you think? Do you think I'm the type of person who would forget?" "No, I don't think so." Silence. I think about my first real girlfriend, and what I am teaching tomorrow, and how hungry I am, and my roommate at home, and whether this anticipated kiss is going to be too big. "I'll drive you closer to your door. It's so wet," Mi-kyung says. "You don't have to." "Thank you. I will always remember you." "I will too. I hope you can be happy with your husband. He sounds like a good man." I shake her hand and hold it, and then come the lips. We kiss goodbye. I step out of the car and walk away from the glowing taillights and out into the rain.
That was Mi-kyung, written and read by Jason Swetnam. Both of Jason's stories come from the multi-author collection There's Going to Be Trouble, published by Life Rattle in the fall of 2013. Jason will read Ron's Smile at this year's Totally Unknown Writers Festival on November 11th at the Rivoli in Toronto, and the story will be published in the festival anthology. This concludes Life Rattle number 1319. My name is Laurie Callis. I recorded Phyllis Mack and Jason Swetnam reading their stories. Life Rattle was created by Arnie Ackman and Guy Allen. Be sure to tune in next week for Life Rattle Classics Show, hosted by Virginia Ashbury.